This is August 13th, 2017. And I'm going to be reading a lengthy review of two books about Buddhism that appears in the current issue of The New Yorker. This is the August 7th and 14th issue. This article was sent to me by about five Sangha members, either by a link or actually a hard copy that I have in front of me. And I figured that with that many people sending me the article, there must be plenty of more people who have read it. And it's a long article. It's exceptionally long for an article in a mainstream magazine, exceptionally long article about Buddhism. And it has an awful lot in it, some that I think is very good and other stuff that's not so good and misleading. So I thought I would tackle this. It's way too long for me to read more than half or a third of it, and it's dense. The writer is Adam Gopnik, who's a staff writer for the longtime staff writer for the New Yorker, and I'm just going to try to pull some threads out of it and weave a teisho out of it. So the article is called "What Meditation Can Do for Us and What It Can't." Examining the Science and Supernaturalism of Buddhism. So, the first, Adam Gopnik, again, is reviewing two books. The first he reviews is a new one called Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. And just to pick up and skip around here, Gopnik says, Wright thinks that Buddhism is true in the immediate sense that it is helpful and therapeutic, and by offering insights into our habitual thoughts and cravings, shows us how to fix them. Being Buddhist, that is, simply practicing vipassana or insight meditation, will make you feel better about being alive, he believes, and he shows how you can and why it does. All right, fair enough. So far, so good. Can be therapeutic, of course. We know anyone who's practiced meditation for long knows how therapeutic can be, helpful, make you feel better. It's a pretty low bar, though, as far as a world religion. But we'll go on. Wright's is a Buddhism almost completely cleansed of supernaturalism. His Buddha is conceived as a wise man and self-help psychologist, not as a divine being. No miraculous birth, no 32 distinguishing marks of the Godhead, no reincarnation. This is a pragmatic Buddhism, and Wright's pragmatism, as in his previous books, can touch the edge of Philistinism. Nearly all popular books about Buddhism are rich in poetic quotation and arresting aphorisms, those ironic koans that are part of the Zen Buddhist decor, tales of monks deciding that it isn't the wind or the flag that's waving in the breeze, but only their minds. Wright's book has no poetry or paradox anywhere in it. Since the poetic comic side of Buddhism is one of its most appealing features, this leaves the book a little short on charm. Yeah, it would have to. There's what Zen and even Buddhism insists always is that our rational way of understanding reality is very limited, and in this case prosaic, and we can't really get at the wonder, the majesty of reality, of the human mind, completely except through something beyond the prosaic explanations. In fact, the closest we can come to expressing the truth, expressing reality is what that means, expressing reality in words is through paradox. And this has no paradox, this book, apparently. So if it without paradox in it, in the book, how can the book be true? That's a question I would pose. And then Gopnik continues, yet if you never feel that Wright is telling you something profound or beautiful, you also never feel that he is telling you something untrue. Direct and unambiguous, tracing his own history in meditation practice, he makes Buddhist ideas and their history clear. Perhaps he makes the ideas too clear. I think of Lin Chi's famous words, to speak of a thing misses the mark. Well, that's always the problem we face when we are in endeavor to talk about the Dharma, that no words can encompass it, which is the point in a tradition like Zen or any Buddhist meditation. Is that's the only way we're going to grasp things as they are, is through direct experience, not through words. So a book that would presume to explain it all has to fall short. And yet there are, of course, there's thousands of volumes of writing in Buddhist history of doctrine, but always it's with the understanding that it's just the finger pointing to the moon. It's not the moon itself. He continues, Buddhist thinkers tend to bridge contradictions with a smile and a paradox and a wave of a hand. This nimble-footed doubleness may indeed hold profound existential truths. It also provides an all-purpose evasion of analysis. Sure, analysis. Analysis is something that is just a function of our discriminating mind, which is just a little fragment of our true mind. And then he gives a little thumbnail summary of Buddhist teaching. That is, this whole article, he's representing these two books. He's not claiming to know himself, but he says that people suffer because the things we cherish inevitably change and rot, and desires are inevitably disappointed. Well, that's not why we suffer, exactly. We suffer because we become attached to things. And all things pass. All things are impermanent. It's the attachment, just to put a finer point on it. And he says that the Buddha also realized that simply by sitting and breathing, people can begin to disengage from the normal run of desires and disappointments and come to grasp that the self, whom the sitter has been serving so frantically and who is suffering from all these needs, is an illusion. Set free from the self's anxieties and appetites and constant, petulant demands, the meditator can see and share the actualities of existence with others. The sitter becomes less selfish and more selfless. Some of this is nice writing. Some of this is, I think, it's a pretty good way of of understanding what we're doing here, what we are striving to do. It's a little not quite accurate to say that simply by sitting and breathing we can disengage from this. It's by sitting and attending to our breathing, or attending to this very moment and refraining from engaging with our thoughts. But this may be a little picky. It's an important point, though. Everyone is sitting and breathing at some time during the day. Then he traces some of the history of Buddhism in North America. He talks about two explosions, one in late 19th century New England, and the second in the 1950s. That's the wave that Philip Kaplow caught that took him to Japan to train. He realized that studying it at Columbia University, even under the great D.T. Suzuki, would never be enough, that he'd have to actually do the practice. So that's when he went back to Japan in 1952. And then he touches on Zen here. He says, Zen, though apparently an atypically severe sect within Buddhism, nervous laughter, an atypically severe sect within Buddhism, came to be the standard bearer, so much so that Zen, quote unquote, became an all-purpose modifier in American letters, meaning challengingly counterintuitive. And then he mentions the two books, Zen and the Art of Archery and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which he says, where you learn how not to aim your arrow or how to find a spiritual practice in a Harley. Yeah, these books, like Alan Watts' books, did a great deal to popularize Zen and make it accessible as a first step toward getting into the practice of it. And he continues, though separated by generations, the deeper grammar of the two Buddhist awakenings was essentially the same. Buddhism in America is simultaneously exotic and familiar. It has lots of Eastern trappings and ceremonies that set it off from the materialism of American life, but it also speaks to an especially American longing for a publicly productive spiritual practice. They have that productive, Protestant ethic. American Buddhism spins off museum collections and vegetarian restaurants and philosophical books, and in the hands of the occasional Buddhist Phil Jackson, the triangle offense in basketball. The Buddhist promise in the American mind is that you can escape and engage. Well, I would say that we can, escape is the wrong word, we never use escape. we can engage with the world while transcending it. And how do we do that? Of course, is by not clinging to thoughts as we are moving through our lives, our daily lives. There's a Christian mystic who referred to be in the world, but not of the world. To be in the world means not to think that we can escape it. It's such an arbitrary thing, the world. I mean, if you live in a mountain resort, a remote, secluded hut in a mountain, still the world. It's just not the world of human socializing and working with other people. This is a big new innovation of Western Buddhism, is what's come to be called engaged Buddhism. I think it's just a matter of emphasis. In Asia, for 2,500 years, they would say they have also engaged Buddhism. They will engage with their monastic environment fully, engage with the trials, the challenges of living with many other people under one roof, but not getting caught in thoughts about all that. That's the challenge. And then he says, "Don't just sit there, do something," is the American entreaty. With Buddhism, you can just sit there and do something. Or, just to play with the language a little bit, the real sitting, the real meditation, is beyond doing. We're really not trying to do anything. If we have in the mind a task or a goal that we're trying to accomplish, this will handicap us in transcending ordinary things. And so the Chinese have this saying, wu wei, which means non-doing. Right, like his Bay Area and Boston predecessors, is delighted to announce the ways in which Buddhism intersects with our own recent ideas. His new version of an American Buddhism is not only self-consciously secularized, but aggressively scientized. He believes that Buddhist doctrine and practice anticipate and affirm the modular view of the mind, favored by much contemporary cognitive science. Then he explains, instead of there being a single, consistent Cartesian self that monitors the world and makes decisions, we live in a kind of, now he just really took off with this analogy, we live in a kind of 90s era Liberia of the mind, populated by warring independent armies implanted by evolution, representing themselves as a unified nation but unable to reconcile their differences, and as one after another wins a brief battle for the capital, providing only the temporary illusion of control and decision. It's the trouble with these kinds of articles. They can be, it's so much easier to read than to hear being read. That's why I skip around so much and leave some of the denser stuff out of there. But let's let him finish his analogy. By accepting that the fixed self is an illusion imprinted by experience and reinforced by appetite, meditation parachutes in a kind of peacekeeping mission that, if it cannot demobilize the armies, lets us see their nature and temporarily disarms their still juvenile soldiers. Again, it's a little too cute. I thinking that we have to go in and do something. Again, our there's nothing really that we're trying to accomplish. That is in the deepest experience of meditation, we're allowing thoughts to settle by sitting still and attending to whatever our practice is, the breath or the koan. We're allowing thoughts to settle. Now, that's not the whole of it, but it's a big part of it. It's definitely a major first step. And then once the thoughts have settled, then we see what's there, what's here. We look. We can't see much if the thoughts are buzzing in our minds. But once they settle, then we can see. things as they are. We're not trying to disarm anything. We don't need to. We're not at war with the mind. And then skipping here, meditation, in Wright's view, is not a metaphysical route toward a higher plane. It is a cognitive probe for self-exploration that underlines what contemporary psychology already knows to be true about the mind. Well, contemporary psychology can approach what Buddhist psychology understands about the mind. Yes, psychology has its value for sure, and can be very helpful in understanding one's neuroses, one's complexes, and how they arise. But all of that is still in the realm of the self. And Buddhism wants to show us what is beyond the self. He continues, according to Buddhist philosophy, both the problems we call therapeutic and the problems we call spiritual are a product of not seeing things clearly, he writes. What's more, in both cases, this failure to see things clearly is in part a product of being misled by feelings. And the first step towards seeing through these feelings is seeing them in the first place, becoming aware of how pervasively and subtly feelings influence our thought and behavior. I don't think I've ever read a summation of Buddhism that puts so much emphasis on feelings as the root of it all. Projections maybe, that are related to feelings. I pulled off the shelf of my office my favorite sutra and Bodhidharma's, coincidentally, the Lankavatara Sutra, because it has the most Buddhist psychology in it. And I just want to give a sense of the difference between a profound sutra like this and this kind of snappy book about psychology. The basic theme of the Lankavatara Sutra is that all of our perceptions are the projections of our own mind, and that liberation, enlightenment, consists in realizing that consciousness is a self-fabricated fiction, just another illusion. And that our job is to free ourselves from the projected world as we see it. Now this goes way down there into the root of it all. All of our perceptions are the projection of our own mind. And that these projections don't arise when we do not grasp external objects. External meaning, broadly speaking, means thoughts. When we're not grasping at our thoughts, when we're not trafficking in our thoughts, we're not playing or pursuing our thoughts, then these projections don't arise, and we see the world, reality, ourself, others, as they are, rather than through the filters of our projections. Of course, this is a project, not just a lifelong project, but lifetimes of work to be able to see beyond the filters. Another, when I read the word feelings here, I'm trying to find common ground with Buddhism, and I, I think of the Chinese masters who talked about subjective emotional consciousness. That's where, because of our what's in our own mind, because of our conditioning, which includes emotions and feelings, we don't see things as they are. We impose or project our own psyche onto them and misinterpret. We distort things. We distort our perceptions because of what we bring to the world. And then he says somewhat the same. He says our feelings, or we could say our projections, ceaselessly generate narratives about the world, and we become their prisoners. We make things good and bad, desirable and undesirable, meaningful and trivial. Wright gives the example of a, quote, buzzsaw symphony as a small triumph of his emancipation. Hearing a buzzsaw whining in the background, what would usually have been a painful distraction, became, robbed by meditation of any positive or negative cues, somehow musical. Meditation shows us how anything can be emptied of the story we tell about it. He tells us about an enlightened man who tastes wine without the contextual tales about vintage, varietal region. It tastes, quote, ... less emotional. All, and he quotes, right, quoting a guru, all the states of equanimity come through the realization that things aren't what we thought they were. Right. What Wright calls the perception of emptiness dampens the affect, but it also settles the mind. If it isn't there, you don't overreact to it. So, I think many people hearing this Teisho have had the experience while sitting of experiencing ambient sounds. Well, like a chainsaw, like the cicadas that we've been hearing just in the last few minutes in the background, like traffic, sounds of traffic, a weed whacker, lawnmower, experiencing them afresh, which means without notions of annoying, pleasant, unpleasant. This is great, great value. Because the coloration we bring to these things causes us to react, and our reactions are what get us into so much trouble and cause so much unnecessary suffering to us, our reacting. People have even had the experience of sitting next to someone in the Zendo who may be, clearing their throat or something or other, where at first it annoys them, and sometimes they'll come and they'll say, report and doksan, the part of that, it's annoying me. And I say, well, just get deeper into your own practice. And then, sure enough, if they manage to do that, then it's not that they don't hear it. They still hear the clearing of the throat, the weed whacker, but it's a different kind of hearing. It's not a problem anymore. It's the same with pain. It's all the senses. It's not just hearing. It's pain. When you feel physical pain, it can be a big deal and a big distraction. But if you can manage to persist in your attention to your practice, then it's still there, but it's not a problem in the same way. This is a tremendous resource that we bring to the world, to our lives. People become less annoying. Experiences become less annoying. We get beyond liking and disliking. just a little sentence here, the gong with which Goldstein, it's a reference to Joseph Goldstein, senior Vipassana teacher, the gong with which Goldstein's meditations begin on YouTube, though a bit of orientalia, does settle the mind and calm its restlessness. And then he makes the mistake of writing the following in parentheses, yet many sounds of seeming serenity, birds singing, leaves rustling, are actually the sounds of ceaseless striving. The birds are shrieking for mates. Even the trees are reaching insistently toward the sun that sustains them. These are the songs of wanting, the songs of life. And that's all the sound of conceptualizing, thinking about all that. And then he addresses Stephen Batchelor's book, most recent book called After Buddhism. He says this shares Wright's object of reconciling the old metaphysics with contemporary cognitive science. Stephen Batchelor's After Buddhism offers a philosophical take on the question. A quote from Batchelor's book, the self may not be an aloof, independent ruler of body and mind, but neither is it an illusory product of impersonal physical and mental forces, he writes. Well, maybe he means that there is this element of intention that we bring. He quotes the Buddha as saying, he says that Gotama is interested in what people can do, not with what they are. The task he proposes entails distinguishing between what is to be accepted as the natural condition of life itself and what is to be let go of, reactivity. And then he gives an example. We may have no control over the rush of fear prompted by finding a snake under our bed, but we do have the ability to respond to the situation in a way that is not determined by that fear. This is a very good point. Now, Stephen Batchelor, I don't know about Robert Wright. I've never heard him about him before, but Stephen Batchelor has a long, long history of practice in Buddhism, starting with being a ordained monk under the Dalai Lama and then moving into Zen. And now he seems to have had a great revelation that we need to make Buddhism secular. To me, that seems like an oxymoron, secular Buddhism. Buddhism is a religion. It has religious elements to it, and we don't need to apologize for that. You don't need to be a Buddhist. You don't need to buy into Buddhist doctrine to practice Zen and go very far. But let's not create something that is contradictory. But just this point about the reactivity. So there can be, in this case, a startle response. We can't override a startle. This is deep, deep evolutionary wiring in our brain. That something like that happens, there's going to be a reaction in the body mind. But what leads us to freedom from our conditioned existence is not clinging to that, to thoughts about the thing. So there's the immediate first Nen experience of startle experience from the snake or the lunging dog or whatever. But then what really generates problems is when we cling to thoughts about it. It's the same with anger. Anger is a natural human response. We all have some least trace of anger arising from time to time. But it's thoughts, our thoughts that bind us to the anger. That makes all the difference. Batchelor also tackles the issue, basically shelved by Wright, of whether Buddhism without any supernatural scaffolding is still Buddhism. Well, that, I would say, is Zen Buddhism. Supernatural. It's a loaded word. We don't have to believe in anything supernatural to practice Zen effectively and go very far in it. But we still can work with the devotional side of our faith, the Buddhist devotions, rituals, the bowing, the chanting. That's not supernatural as I understand it. What's supernatural is this old belief in Buddhism that there is this Mount Sumeru at the center of the universe. At the center of the universe is this great mountain called Mount Sumeru. Really? And yet, probably tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of monks have believed that throughout history, that there is this Mount Sumeru. We don't have to believe that. Zen is about practice. It's not about belief. It's about sitting and then extending that mind of stabilized awareness into our daily life. It has nothing to do with believing supernatural things. And yet, let's not entirely dismiss beliefs in supernatural things. I think this would be very arrogant. I mean, to do that is to dismiss the intelligence of primitive peoples throughout time. There's a great statement by Goethe, the German philosopher. Superstition is rooted in a much deeper and more sensitive layer of the psyche than skepticism. Sounds like both of these, what these two books have in common is a great deal of skepticism. We don't have to reject things. Can we find a middle way between where we neither reject these things nor get attached to them or believe in them? We don't have to believe in them. There's something to them. There's a deeper level of truth. It's like novels. Novels that are entirely pure fiction have a great deal of truth to them. He poses the question, can we really tiptoe past the elaborate supernaturalism of historical Buddhism? Yes. And then he continues with this discussion of supernaturalism. He says, Batchelor tap dances perilously close to the often repeated absurdity that a highly credulous belief about supernatural claims and an extremely skeptical belief about supernatural claims are really the same because they are both beliefs. And I don't. Why is that absurd? Yes, it's like the atheist. The atheist maintains that there is no God. Well, how do you know? We want to get beyond beliefs, beyond taking positions. He continues, a deeper objection to the attempted reconciliation of contemporary science and Buddhist practice flows from the nature of scientific storytelling. The practice of telling stories, imagined tales of cause and effect that fixate on the past and the future while escaping the present, sending us back and forth without being here now, is something that both Wright and Batchelor see as one of the worst delusions the mind imprints on the world. Okay, but that's half of it. Half of it is that there is that which is beyond causation and causal and non-causal, acausal. In back to the Lankavatara Sutra, very short statement here by the Buddha, attributed to the Buddha. He says, I do not teach that there are causes, nor do I teach that there are no causes. I only teach causation as a fabrication of projecting the existence of a subject and an object. So again, Buddhism is not contrary to science. No way. It's just that Buddhism recognizes another realm that is beyond both causation and non-causation. We recite this in the Hakuin chant that we just did about 45 minutes ago, where Hakuin says, the gateway to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. What Wright sees correctly as the heart of meditation practice, the draining away of the stories we tell compulsively about each moment in favor of simply having the moment, is antithetical to the kind of evidentiary argument he admires. And then, but not to get hung up on all that, but he says, science is competitive storytelling. If a Buddhist Newton had been sitting under that tree, he would have seen the apple falling and, reaching for enlightenment, experienced each moment of its descent as a thing pure in itself. Only a restless Western Newton would say, now, what story can tell us best what connects those apple moments from branch to ground? Sprites? Magnets? The mysterious force of the mass of the earth beneath it? What made the damn thing fall? And it's true that in just the pure realm of no mind, no thought, those things would not arise. It's just plump. But there's nothing wrong with then, as a scientist, raising those questions. That these two can coexist. These two realms. In Buddhism, we talk about these two sides of reality. There's the essence and there's the function. The essence is beyond causality, beyond this and that, all duality, cause and effect. The function is all about cause and effect. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff record called Chimon and the Essence of Prajna. Prajna means wisdom, transcendental wisdom. A monk asked Chimon, what is the essence of Prajna? Chimon said, an oyster swallowing the bright moon. The monk said, what is the function of Prajna. Chimon said, a hair conceiving by the full moon. Essence and function, these are the two sides of reality. Just a few more sentences before we end. He says, what Wright is doing seems an honorable, even a sublime achievement. Basically, he says that meditation has made him somewhat less irritable. Being somewhat less irritable is not the kind of achievement that people usually look to religion for, but it may be as good an achievement as we ought to expect. No, you're selling it short. It's better than nothing, sure. Being less irritable is being better than being more irritable, but this doesn't even scrape the surface of the kind of transformation that we can experience through Zen meditation. And just the last part here. Secularized or traditional, the central Buddhist epiphany remains essential. The fact of mortality makes loss certain. For all the ways in which science and its blessed godchild, scientific medicine, have reduced the overt suffering that a human life entails, the vector to sadness remains in place as much as it did in the Buddha's time. Gotama's death, from what one doctor describes as mesenteric infarction, seems needlessly painful and gruesome by modern standards. This is the kind of suffering we can substantially alleviate. But the universal mortality of all beings, the fact that, if we're lucky, we will die after 70 years or so, is not reformable. This is what it all comes down to. Is the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. This is what religion is all about, to come to terms with that, not just to be less irritable. The larger problem we face is not suffering, but sadness, and the sadness is caused by the fact of loss. Well, sadness is a kind of suffering. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I now do the great endless blind passions, I bow above root, darn the gaze beyond measure, I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I bow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions, I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure, I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions I bow to uproot. Dharma gates beyond measure I bow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha.